Yeah, we are here today with senior Atlas Society senior scholar Richard Salzman talking about America First as egoistic foreign policy. You know, we're just getting started. With no further ado, Richard, I'm very interested in hearing this, especially in the context of your discussion tomorrow.
Thank you, Scott. And this is, in a way, a kind of preface to what Rob Trzezinski and I will do tomorrow. We're going to have a discussion moderated by David Kelly on the Russia-Ukraine war. It takes place at 9:30. This is a different time usually for us, 9:30 a.m. But I believe it'll be recorded and made available later. So that will, I think, be more focused on the application of these principles and how Rob and I may differ to the specific case of Ukraine, Russia. So I thought today that I, and even when I set this up originally, I thought I would focus more on a broad theory and principles that I think should be guiding foreign policy. Now, I use the word America First because that's obviously the Trump language, but whether we agree or not with Trump's policies, including foreign policies, the sentiment is right. The idea that even on an individual level, egoism entails you putting yourself first, which is a hierarchical thing. It's not an issue of putting yourself only or putting yourself in a position that's necessarily antagonistic to others. So I think it captures it nicely. Now, I speak about egoistic foreign policy. The backdrop, of course, should be obvious that egoism itself is not a respected ethical code, either in academia or in philosophy generally. Ayn Rand is unique in her defense of egoism, especially by bringing into play the idea that it has to be rational egoism, that it has to be long range, that it has to be fully contextual. And there are so many caricatures, really crazy cartoonish caricatures of the self-interested person, that this manifests itself in foreign policy as well. But and so a lot of brush has to be cleared in that regard. So I believe the same kind of suspicions that moralists and others have about whether the individual should be acting egoistically is transposed into the foreign field, that the relationship not among individuals but among nations, and help causes the same kind of havoc, not only not recognizing what egoism is, but prizing prizing altruism, the idea that the moral thing to do is to sacrifice yourself. Well, if a country's to do that, and if it's to do that, especially because it's in a more superior, strong position, which the U.S. typically has been, it's just an atrocious result. And I'll go through some of those, but again, the idea here is to speak more on principles, and maybe in the Q&A, people can ask about specifics. But just to put a teaser out there, I have been saying for many years now, and it's somewhat provocative, but I think it's undisputable, the U.S. Can't win wars anymore. The U.S. has lost 5 wars in a row, starting with Korea. And I define that in a specific way, you know, is the original aggressor still in place afterwards, and all sorts of other things. But that is quite shocking, actually, and remarkable. But I think it's traceable to the suspicion of egoism and the fact that it should not be guiding U.S. foreign policy. Now, there is a separation worth making between foreign policy and, call it, war policy. Foreign policy, obviously, deciding not only relations among nations, but whether to go to war or not, and when and with whom. But then there is also an issue of once you're at war, once you're in war, how do you conduct the war? And they're the same thing. If you are guided, even though you go to war seemingly in your self-interest, if you go to war with an altruistic approach that makes you tie your hands, that makes you less than fully committed to winning the war, that leads to disasters. And I think that's exactly what's happened with the last 5 U.S. wars. So quite apart from whether the U.S. should have been in those wars or not, once they were in them, they didn't really execute them in a vigorous, in a kind of total war approach. Okay, so back to foreign policy. It's sometimes, I think, troubling or confusing to the individualist, to the capitalist, maybe even to the objectivist, to speak of a nation's national self-interest. It just doesn't sound right. It sounds too collectivist. But I think it's objectively demonstrable that if you can identify the identity of the United States of America, then you and its essence, and then you can start speaking about what is in its fundamental interest, and then you can start speaking about how it deals with other nations. We do have nation states, that's unavoidable. We do have, of course, non-state actors like terrorist groups and groups like the UN and stuff. So, but we are in a realm of nation states, and I think it's not too far-fetched to use them metaphorically and realistically as the equivalent of individuals on a national stage. But there is no overarching government, as we know. And so, as David Kelly and others have noted, you could characterize international relations as what political theorists call a state of nature, in effect, anarchy, with no, if there's no overarching government. So all the more important, I would say, that each nation needs to figure out what its essence is, what its self-interest is, and then act accordingly. In one word, the essence of America is liberty. I mean, we can flesh out all the other aspects of it, meaning including rights, including how government is constitutionally restricted. And you could certainly go through, you know, the holy trinity of life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. I would put in there property as well. But really, manifestations of liberty, the idea is the person in America is free. And that is the sole obligation of government, to preserve, protect, and defend the freedom of its citizens. Now, in the objectivist, Nozick, libertarian, minarchist view, you're probably familiar with the idea that, well, this in function, if that's the purpose to preserve liberty, the key functions, the three key functions to serve the purpose are domestic police, courts, and a military. Now, let's focus on the military. It's really national defense with an emphasis on defense. It's not offense, it's defense. It's not defense of non-Americans, it's defense of Americans. It's defense of American citizens. It's the defense and the preservation of their rights. Not, and by the way, this is in the Constitution as well, not the rights of others. We can care about the rights of others, of non-US citizens, of other countries. But fundamentally, if you don't start with this America first approach, you can easily sacrifice and dilute and adulterate the rights, and including the rights of citizens, and including the power and prestige of America, which indirectly undermines its ability to protect the rights of citizens. I stress defense here also from to just distinguish this from the typical critique of capitalism as imperialistic. The critique of capitalism as colonialist, as outward aggressive. That's just a Marxist myth. And actually, it's a leftover of the pre-capitalist system called mercantilism. Mercantilism, which was dominant as a theory and practice prior to Adam Smith writing The Wealth of Nations in 1776. It was mercantilism, basically the argument against free trade. The premise that nations are necessarily antagonistic, at each other's throats, zero-sum game. That is actually what led to the more imperialist empire building and war promotion of that era. We had eras of peace after it was argued and shown that rational and free nations only benefit by trading with each other and dealing with each other. Now, the issue of, I want to talk now about the issue of once, I'll use America as an example, identifies the essence and says this is what's going to guide our foreign policy. The next important step is to characterize very scrupulously, actually, the status of all other nations in the world vis-a-vis your self-interest. I mean, this would be equivalent of if you knew your own character and you knew your own interests and you're not living in isolation, and we're not arguing for, in foreign policy, isolationism, the hermit life. You know, we wouldn't have that personally. It is necessary to judge who you deal with, friends, family, acquaintances, strangers. according to that same objective standard, namely, who is good for my freedom, who is good for my values, who and likewise identifying those who are not good. Now, not good is kind of mild, but what about threats? That's obvious. You need to identify your enemies and act accordingly, and basically have a foreign policy with you know, the friends, family, and others that you deal with. So we all have personal foreign policies, if you think about it, and alliances. And these may shift over time because people change their character and people change their interests. So it's not something that's fixed in time. In the issue of foreign policy, therefore, it becomes incumbent upon, and this is really the State Department, a nation State Department, a perfectly legitimate agency, by the way, and originally an agency of the U.S. government when it was formed, needs to identify and characterize all other nations. And identify them as, now, is this going to be black and white? I would hope it could be back black and white, but it often can't be. But to characterize them as friend or foe for the purpose of guiding foreign policy and for the purpose of guiding every other aspect of it, including, say, diplomacy, embassies, whether there's any military aid or alliances, whether there's any economic pacts or not. There is a treaty provision, as you know, in the U.S. Constitution. So that's legitimate as well. But remember the admonition of Washington, our first great president, endorsed by Alexander Hamilton, who advised him heavily on foreign policy as well. No entangling alliances, and certainly no long-term permanent ones. So this wasn't the idea that U.S. foreign policy should be capricious and unpredictable. It was that the U.S. should not tie itself to others who were capricious and unpredictable. And in this case, particularly, they had in mind Europe, Spain, Britain, and others in Europe who had the U.S. allied, or in France, and had the U.S. allied with any one of them, it would have been problematic. To my knowledge, the State Department really does not do this. It does have things like terrorist lists. It does have other things like lists of nations that do or don't respect religious freedom and things like that. But I'm just laying out the basic principles here. That has to be a necessary part of a government's designation of friends and allies. Now, friends and foes. Now, one of the other reasons for doing this is for having policy toward, call it, trading with the enemy. It's very unclear to many people, you know, like right now someone might say, should the U.S. government do anything about businesses that trade with China? Well, if China is not designated as a threat or a foe of the United States, the answer would be no. There should not be the government preventing that. It hasn't been designated as an enemy. Now, might it be designated as an enemy? Might there be a rational basis for doing so? Set that aside. If there is, then I believe it's legitimate on the part of the government to restrain private citizens for literally aiding and abetting an enemy. But short of that, there should not be restrictions. I think it's very interesting. If you look up one of the few essays that Ayn Rand wrote on foreign policy, there is not a lot of writing on foreign policy. If you know, she said something. I think I have it in front of me. That one of the key principles of foreign policy, the quote, the essence of capitalism's foreign policy, is free trade. The abolition of trade barriers or protective tariffs or special privileges, the opening up of the world's trade routes to free international exchange and competition among the private citizens of all countries dealing directly with one another, unquote. That's from The Roots of War. Isn't it interesting that the essence, I mean, she said the essence is an economic aspect to it. Very interesting. And in that regard, you could classify Hoover in the 20s and Trump during his reign as violating the basic essence and principles of a foreign policy by being protectionists. I think it was Bastiat once who said, when goods can't cross borders, armies will. And this is an unrecognized part of the foreign policy mix, how economic trade and interactions. And, you know, and it's not just trade in goods, it's trade in labor, capital, the movement of labor, capital, and goods across borders. At any rate, I think that's the beginning of an answer to the question of, well, how does a government deal with its own citizens and companies in regards to others? It has to first designate these other states objectively and carefully, and then go from there. Now, I wanted to say something about, and I'll stop. I think it's about 4:18 now. I was aiming to stop about 4:25, 4:30 at most. And then it'll open it up for questions.
Okay.
The issue of, I want to say something about the issue of now, once you have designated states as friends, then the question becomes how friendly and how much should there be an alliance? I still think the principle that the government's essential sole goal is to protect the rights of its citizens, the issues of whether to have alliances with other like-minded pro-liberty countries is important, but I think it can't be a kind of permanent thing. I think it has to be based on circumstances. So, for example, Britain being faced with destruction by Nazi Germany, you could, no matter how interventionist, how mixed economy Britain had become by World War II, and so had the U.S., of course, it still was objectively an ally. And the extermination, which was not an improbable thing, of Britain was against America, I would say, would it be against America's self-interest. And so I don't believe this issue of egoism driving our foreign policy means we never ally with other true allies, and including militarily. And by the way, in the background of all this, let's just stipulate none of this is done with a draft. No capitalist system of foreign policy and military prowess kidnaps its own citizens and forces them to go to war. So I assume that's understood by everybody, but the capitalist foreign policy and war policy has to include voluntarism and a well-paid professional standing army. I mean, that was disputed between Hamilton and Jefferson, the Jeffersonian approach, which was there should be no permanent standing army. His view was that it would lead to too much war. But Hamilton and Washington had the view that you had to professionalize this. This was a key function of government, and these people had to be professionally trained, and that means, and then also paid well. Just to go on the negative side now, if you are motivated, if the government is not motivated by egoism, but rather altruism, it's not going to see the rights of its citizens as a primary. It's going to be very open to the idea of sacrificing them because they think it's noble. Sacrificing them for the sake of helping others, including others, and maybe even especially others who don't deserve it. Other nations who are exposed, other nations who are under attack, other nations who haven't taken the effort to defend themselves or create their own alliances. That's going on with the Ukraine now, I believe. And it's a very dangerous approach because if this is what's considered moral, it's going to involve the United States in a whole bunch of conflicts that it either does not advance its self-interest or actually undermines it. By going into a fight, it doesn't want to. It doesn't really want to win, and I think this is one of the reasons why Korea and Vietnam and the Gulf War in 1990, then the Iraq War, and the horrendous performance in the Afghan War. After 20 years, the U.S. left Afghanistan with the Taliban still in power and even greater force, and leaving something like $80 billion in armaments and military in that place. It was just a disgusting performance that only could be explained by a refusal to win the war quickly and in America's self-interest, national self-interest. I have other things to say, but I'll stop there. Well, let me just one more thing about as alliances, NATO. I'll talk more about NATO tomorrow, but to me, NATO is an example, even during the Cold War. NATO was formed in 1949. There's an example of an alliance the U.S. was in. The U.S. was central in creating the alliance. It began with 12 countries, and it was purportedly to restrain this and defend against the Soviet Union after World War II. But the U.S. had built up the Soviet Union during World War II by allying with the Soviet Union. So the original policy of bringing the Soviet Union into the fight against Germany and arming and the Lend-Lease Act and all the other things the U.S. did for Stalin was itself a disgusting display of non-egoism. And so notice that afterwards, the negotiated settlement was giving over many, many Eastern European countries to the Soviet Union. And then the felt need to say, well, since they're very powerful, we need to create NATO, which amounts to what? The United States committing to provide national defense to a range of other countries. To me, that's just self-sacrificing. That is not either constitutional or rationally egoistic. And we could talk more about this, but once you get into the issue of first deciding whose friends and enemies are, even if you find friends, some of the alliances may not be rationally egoistic, and I certainly don't think NATO was. All right, I will stop there because I know there's probably some questions and comments.
Okay, great. Let's get right into it. Clark, thank you. Go ahead.
Yes, Richard, thank you so much for this presentation. I had a very specific question. It has to do with congressional declarations of war. My understanding is we haven't actually had one since World War II. And so I'm wondering, you know, right now it looks like Congress has voted to send literally billions of dollars of military and economic aid to Ukraine, yet there's no declaration of war. So what are your thoughts on that? I mean, it seems like if we really needed to have a declaration of war to do this, we would actually commit more of our resources and instead of just doing what we're doing now, which is kind of sending aid, becoming a co-belligerent in this fight, which is kind of dangerous, all without any kind of congressional declaration.
Clark, I think that's a really important point. And I totally endorse the sentiment I'm hearing from you. It is in the Constitution that it's for Congress to declare war. And of course, the commander in chief is the president. So the separation of powers there is very clear and it's very important. And I think absolutely that quite apart from the principles I named, which is to, you know, designate countries as friends or foes, The idea of declaring war brings with it the idea that there's a debate, the idea that it's discussed, the idea that it's not something that's just unilaterally entered into. So it gives gravity to the situation, and that is a source of avoiding error. I mean, if you can have a really robust debate, it's really quite amazing actually when you think about it, because most military people do not want the pros and cons of war or the possible strategies and outcomes discussed openly in the public. But you're right, when the U.S. did that in prior wars, it did better in the wars. And so I do think it's a check on going into the wrong wars. I do think the draft itself the volunteer army, I should say, putting it positively, is also a check on this. Because if you can just draft people and kidnap them and send them into any crazy conflict, that will also get the U.S. into self-sacrificing wars. So the draft has been, I think the draft was dropped by Nixon in 1973. So that was an important thing to do. But notice, bad wars can still be done on a voluntary army. But you're absolutely right. The fact that there's no declarations anymore, these resolutions that are done on the side, it's giving the executive branch, really, and the Pentagon unlimited power to engage in war. And frankly, they're already engaging in war by sending military aid and advisors, all over the world to a range of different places. So, the lack of a declaration and a quote-unquote starting point for mobilization is a real problem, because the things are done gradually and surreptitiously and nobody really knows about it and there's no accountability. And the next thing one of our battalions or one of our ships is blown up and people are saying, why were we in the middle of that? We didn't know that was going on. So Yeah, so we really have to get back to that. That's like a bare minimum that it actually be discussed and there be a formal declaration. One more reason for declarations. They usually entail declarations of emergency, giving the government, you know, kind of extra legal powers. So it's they're dangerous itself to be in wartime. That's when liberties are most at risk. You're going to war presumably to preserve people's liberties. So you really want a case where you've been attacked or likely to be attacked. It's really got to be a self-defense thing. But wars are also dangerous because, you know, in a way they militarize society and you risk losing your liberties. So one benefit that comes from declaring war and then knowing you're on a war standing is at some point you end the process. At some point you terminate the conditions. And that's not what we have today. We have not only no declarations, but open-ended commitments of the kind, you know, 20 years in Afghanistan, that kind of thing. Would not have been allowed had there been a declaration. And the declarations, I believe if you look closely, it actually says in the Constitution that the declarations can, that the war can only last 2 years and then it has to be renewed. I mean, that is amazing. And an amazingly good kind of a sunset provision in there. That's been flouted for years, as you know. So a good point, Clark.
Good stuff. Thank you, Roger. Thanks for joining.
Yeah, no, I love joining the room when Richard's here. Richard, you're one of my favorite people to talk to about
economics. Thank you, Rod. Thank you,
but
Roger.
I will say, when it comes to foreign policy, I have yet to find somebody from the Atlas Society that I 100% agree with. I'm looking forward to the day that you and Jason Hill can hash out your differences as it relates to the conflict in Ukraine. But that aside, I think this America First thing is interesting, right? Because to frame it as egoistic foreign policy, that's one way to look at it. But I also think that we need to remember that voluntary associations can happen, that are in your rational best interest, to use a RAND term. And I think that countries can do what's in their rational best interest. And so the self-interest of America could absolutely be to partner with other nation states that decide that they have common goals. Now, I would agree that we have to be very careful with these entanglements and make sure that we're, you know, entering voluntary associations that make sense. But there's been a lot of critique, you know, that I've heard of NATO that to me doesn't make sense, because it to me it feels like we forget the threat that the Soviet Union had and the ambitions that I would argue are still there within certain people within Russia today. There was a reason why NATO was created and formed. There's a reason why additional countries that were on the border of Russia and were former Warsaw Pact countries that know this threat better than Americans ever will. And for them to voluntarily choose to join this organization, I don't think that is a weakness. And so I guess to frame it in a question is, what do you have against voluntary associations as it comes to
Well, I'm not against voluntary associations. I want the U.S. foreign policy to be driven by rational egoism, and I don't believe that the U.S. involvement in NATO does that. In fact, it does the opposite. It sacrifices America, both in terms of prestige and wealth and other things. Now, let me just say quickly that why I would say something like this. When NATO was formed in 1949 and there were 12 countries, including the United States, you're right, there was a Soviet Union. So there's a case where, how do you identify the Soviet Union? I would have identified it as a threat to the United States. They were known for being driven by, motivated by Marxist view of internationalism, the idea of being against capitalism and therefore being against America as the quintessential capitalist country. So they went with nuclear weapons. So they were clearly an enemy of the United States. And I think the United States, it becomes a matter of calculation whether joining with other nations helps America defend itself against the Soviet Union. But that's not how NATO was put together. NATO was put together with the idea that the non-US members would get their military protection from the United States, and therefore they did not spend as much as they would or work as well together in defending themselves. So here was a case where America was basically violating the constitutional obligation to devote its military and finances only to protecting Americans. The commitment was to protect Brits and Canadians and the French and the Belgians. And to me, that's just not proper. It is not proper for the United States to have others outsource their military basically to the United States, to have American taxpayers forced to spend on helping defend foreign citizens. Now, looked at from a non-U.S. perspective, it's a standard thing, Roger, that, you know, if you're a grown-up country, you have a military. You don't become a colony of the United States. In effect, that's what it is. It is colonialism. It's France saying, we're not going to spend much on the military. We'll just have the U.S. do it. And they become basically a client state of the United States. I'm against that. And it actually makes Europe more vulnerable. Now, when there was NATO, even if you supported NATO, you could at least say, well, it was up against the Warsaw Pact. So in other words, an equivalent alliance on the other side, the Soviet Union plus all the Eastern satellites. But we'll talk more about this tomorrow. But once the Cold War ended in 1991, it was even more ludicrous, I believe, to have NATO. Because now you had NATO up against not the Soviet Union, but a severely degraded Russia, a Russia that was barely getting back on its feet. After dissolution, they changed in character enormously. The Russia of post 1991, especially for the first decade, was nothing like the Soviet Union under Stalin, Khrushchev, and others. So that wasn't recognized by the United States. Here's a case where just the identification process was wrong. They couldn't even get the identification process right as to what now the Russians were to us. You know, they were not any longer a mortal enemy of the United States, and yet they were treated that way by keeping NATO not only up and running, but then expanding for the next 30 years. That's actually what's happened. NATO is now 30 countries, not 12, up again, moving east, ever eastward toward Russia in a very combative way. So I'll leave it at that, but I know what you're saying. You could say that NATO is a voluntary association, but of course, the non-U.S. members would gleefully want to join a group where its military defense is being paid for by the American taxpayers. But it's not voluntary to the American taxpayer.
All right. Thank you for that. Lawrence, thanks for joining us. Do you have a question for Richard? Lawrence, are you able to unmute? He may be indisposed. Let's go to John.
Hello. Richard, when you opened, and indeed the title of this program is about egoistic foreign policy and how there's been a zeitgeist opposition to that since the mid-20th century, and that's why we lost all these wars. And I think that the reason is that the zeitgeist is fundamentally egalitarian. And frankly, that's why I support the Atlas Society. It's because of individualism and of the dysfunctionality of the egalitarian ethic, which I believe is primarily motivated out of a sense of envy. And what we're really talking about is an argument over property and property rights. And envy is about stealing somebody else's property, and jealousy is about keeping your property. And I think that's what all of the political arguments at their roots are about. I'll leave it at that for the moment.
Thank you, John. That's an interesting take, and I think there's some truth to it in the following way. Just as there's animosity, domestically, say, toward those of unequal wealth, and the premise and the some assumption that the rich got that way by impoverishing the poor, that there's an class antagonism of the Marxist variety. And that egalitarianism is the idea that, you know, whether it's equality of opportunity or equality of result or what now is called equity, yeah, it's felt that the just and proper and moral thing to do is to level, and especially level downward if you can't level upward. On the international stage, John, I think it's true that if you apply this to the international stage, the idea is, well, because the U.S. is, what do they used to call it after the Cold War? The sole superpower. And there are theorists in foreign policy who, even though they may have welcomed the fact that the United States, in effect, won the Cold War and the Soviet Union did not, would still say it's an unstable or unfair or unjust arrangement because it's unequal. And they would dismiss the idea, well, who cares if it's unequal as long as the United States is a liberty-loving, rights-respecting republic? Why do you care? You know, why should anyone care that it's, you know, bigger, more powerful?
Yes. Than others? And I would add that there's an epistemological aspect to that.
Okay.
It's particularly with regard to Ukraine. That is, for example, if I'm walking across down a busy street in the evening, and I look across the street 150 feet away, and I see some guy, it looks like he's getting mugged. There's a couple of guys who accosted him.
Yeah.
I don't know what's going on, but I may feel like I need to run across the street and help that poor guy. But maybe I don't know that they're accosting him because he raped their sister yesterday or because he's a bad guy. And so that's my feeling when I thought we're talking about Ukraine or all kinds of other international things where we're supposed to get involved or somebody is advocating it. I don't really know what's going on. And we see the propaganda war that's going on now over Ukraine. And it's almost like global warming, you know, or climate change or any of the, transgenderism. I don't know what's right. You know, it's hard. I'll leave it at that.
Okay, John. Thanks.
Thanks, John. I think skepticism, you know, that the only reason we're not intervening is we just don't know enough. It's interesting. I'm not sure the metaphor carries, because if you're in the United States and you see someone being beaten up on Park Avenue, and I think you're absolutely right. You don't know what's going on. What is that fight all about? But notice what would be the normal result, that the police are brought in. And on the international scale, what is that equivalent to? There isn't any international police. You know, there isn't, that's the whole point of international relations, are in what's called a state of nature. It's anarchy in the sense that there are states, but there's no overarching state to make sure all the other states behave. Now, I believe actually this is one of the reasons why the interventionists, that's not really the right word for them, want the U.S. to be the policeman of the world and make the world safe for democracy, and all these other phrases you get from the what's called the idealist school in foreign policy as opposed to the realists. I think it's an understandable desire, because it's seen as so workable domestically, you know, that you have to have police, courts, and law and order. So the idea of, if there's no law and order internationally, let's get that. I think that's behind the sympathy for the United Nations now. But these tend to be impractical institutions. And the key here, though, is even if the U.S. could play this role, and I think increasingly it can't because it's at war with itself, really. But even if the U.S. could play that role, it's not clear that that's in the self-interest of the United States. Because it isn't just Russia, Ukraine. There are conflicts and wars going on, civil and otherwise, all the time. There would be no end to the U.S. Playing policeman of the world, and to the total sacrifice, I believe, the United States. So that's a whole separate question of should there be a policeman of the world, and how and why, and should the U.S. be any part of that? But that's it's a good question. It's a good point.
Great. Lawrence, thank you for coming back.
Hello, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. So Richard, my question is sort of along a slightly different line of this, but it relates to, I know, you know, back in the day, President Eisenhower was talking about the military-industrial complex and the concerns about it, but nothing really happened as a result. And now when we talk about these large amount of weapon shipments going overseas, especially, you know, Javelin missiles and other things, and the ramping up of the military-industrial industry to support those needs, we've seen in other areas of our government where there is this alignment of interest between private and public sector, especially when it comes to like big tech and the government. Is there anything that we should maybe be considering or be even being concerned about when it comes to this industry for war, more or less, that they would have an influence in making us go and actually use the things they create?
Good question. I've changed my view on this over the years. When I first heard about this doctrine, and I was born in the late 50s, so I didn't hear it real time. But when I first came to learn about the military-industrial complex and Eisenhower's warning, that was his farewell warning, I tended to just classify it and dismiss it as a kind of Marxist, snarky criticism of, you know, the capitalist war profiteers and all that, and that it would come from a military hero and giant like Eisenhower actually made people sit up and say, wow, does he know something we don't know? But he can't be in the pay of communists, can he be? Or in Marxist ideology, can he be? And it seemed like just an unfair smear. Now, fast forward, that was, what, 1960 when he said it. Fast forward 60 years, and I have come to believe that this is a problem, that you do see munitions makers, and not just that, of the whole constellation of Pentagon officials and I would add the media now. So to me, it's the media and military-industrial complex. The media loves wars. They love, if it bleeds, it leads, all that kind of stuff. And if it's international bleeding, they love it. And it's become like a sport to them. And they get more eyeballs. It's kind of disgusting. And it's understandable because war is, you know, an outlier. It's news. It's truly news. But I do believe there's a problem with the interaction between the Pentagon and the military munitions providers and the motivations. But this is something that it's proper for a capitalist country not to nationalize its munitions industries. They should be independent companies. They should be privately owned companies. But it's a very delicate thing because they negotiate contracts to provide things to the U.S. military. And you don't want a case where where the Pentagon is basically getting involved in things in interminable and heavily costly wars because it's also in the interest of the munitions makers. I think I saw an estimate that $6 to $7 trillion was spent by the U.S. on Iraq and Afghanistan alone. That is 1/4 of the national debt. That is just incredible. And when you see things like leaving $83 billion in war materiel created by the U.S. on the tarmac in Afghanistan, and when you hear why is that? Like, why didn't they bring it back? Or when you hear stories of, you know, let's have Poland send things to Ukraine so we can get around the fact that Ukraine's not in NATO, but then U.S. armament makers will, you know, rearm Poland. It's almost like it's a racket almost. It seems almost like a racket. And imagine if you said to these munition makers, we're not going to have NATO anymore. Let the non-U.S. NATO members provide for their own national defense. They would be scared. They would be scared terribly that their business would collapse. So NATO and the U.S. leading NATO and being in the biggest part of NATO is something that the munition makers really like. Now, it isn't as if France, Germany, and others couldn't buy munitions from U.S. munitions makers, but they probably would buy far less. They would probably have a much less robust military if there was no NATO.
Yeah, they're not paying their fair share as it is.
Right.
Thank you for that. Carl, thank you for waiting. Do you have a question? Are you able, you click your microphone to unmute. I tell you what, while you're figuring that out, we're going to go ahead to Atlas Society founder David Kelly. Thank you for joining us, and go ahead.
Thank you, Richard. That was a very astute analysis of foreign policy, and I appreciate it. And
thank you, David.
We try to be brief here because we'll have a chance tomorrow to air these issues more fully in the discussion about with Rob Brzezinski about debate about Ukraine. Sorry. I just wanted to push on two points. One is that, the understanding of defense is that the U.S., any country, but the U.S. in particular, should defend its citizens against aggression or the threat of it. And my sense is that a lot of differences in foreign policy depend on how you define threat, what you regard and interpret it as a threat.
Yeah.
The other wiggle room, the other issue that is kind of open and a source of disagreement is going back to Ayn Rand's point about free trade. To what extent, if that is the most important aspect of foreign policy, trade, international trade is truly important in a positive way. Defense is a negative function, but trade is a very positive one for all the reasons you know and summarized and know perfectly well as an economist. And in that respect, having a foreign policy that encourages trade can lead to alliances, trade agreements, and so forth. So NATO is a defense agreement against what was a threat that went away after the fall of communism, but is now, it seems like it's back with Putin and his, what he's done in Russia and become a more significant threat than 20 years ago, or 30 years ago, rather. But also, we have expanding trade and the desire of Eastern European countries and now Ukraine in being part of that commercial, the commercial freedom of trade. Seems it is one issue that people on the other side of this issue from you would cite as a positive reason for us to be involved. I'm not arguing one side or the other. I just want to know, here, these seem to me like the two issues, the definition of what counts as a threat and the definition of what, how much we should invest in promoting free trade. Would you say those are the important issues that we should be, that should help us understand and more fully refine our sense of American self-interest?
I would. I do endorse that. And on the first point, David, the distinguishing aggression from threat. Well, we know in domestically, the right of self-defense includes not only, once you're punched, but if you're threatened to be punched, attempted murder, attempted murder, that kind of thing. So aggression would be Pearl Harbor, in cases where they, or 9/11. But even threats like Germany declares war against America, that's a threat. And if it's coming from a Nazi Germany, the U.S. turn around and we declare war against you and you're at war. So that's a threat, though. It wasn't Germany that, directly hurt the U.S. But I think, yes, in cases where there's a threat. Or now a murkier case might be something like Iran that continually says, death to America or death to Israel. Now, you could say that's a threat, but you can also say, well, they're not like Nazi Germany. They're not like the Soviet Union, even. They're not likely to carry out the threat. But I would lean in the direction of saying, okay, is that a declaration of war? We get to go to war against Tehran. I don't know how often they'd be saying it if that were the case. So I agree with that. I think those are ways in which the foreign policy, shifts into military policy. The second one I think is interesting because it is true that the more trade you have, and if that is the goal of a foreign policy, the more you entangle yourself in a way, but in a good way. And I think, David, one of the difficulties I have is working through the idea of the good side is you're trading with more countries, but now also if there's any military conflict between any of them, you're maybe in a situation of saying, well, should I protect my trading partner? I mean, what it's not true, but suppose we got half our grain from Ukraine. Russia didn't actually attack us, but it attacked our trading partner. And it might actually, you know, interfere with the Americans being fed. That might be a reason to intervene in the Ukraine-Russia thing. But it would be, but notice it would be driven by American self-interest. It wouldn't be driven by, you know, we feel sorry for these Ukrainians. Or exactly. We feel sorry because Russia is a bully and Ukraine is a victim. You know, that the altruism that goes with these things is so overt. It's almost like overt. Someone's suffering, therefore we have to get involved. Someone's a perpetrator, therefore we have to get involved. That kind of thing. So I hope that helps, but I things like the WTO and others that attempt to promote free trade, I'm generally of the view, although people do disagree about this, that the more you trade with other countries, the more the exchanges you have back and forth, the less likely you're going to go to war with them. And there is, we've talked about this before in other webinars, there is a fascinating literature called The Capitalist Peace, or sometimes it's called The Democratic Peace. There's a book that was first published called Never at War, where political scientists have well documented that generally freer countries just don't go to war against each other. And that was actually the motivation for the George W. Bush policy of the forward strategy of freedom. Now, that was unique to the Middle East. He wanted to promote democracy and freedom in the Middle East. But the premise is interesting. He started with this premise of, well, free countries don't aggress. So let's try to make them free countries.
Yeah.
and there's a certain twisted logic to that. But if they have no culture, as you and I know, they have no cultural or philosophic grounding for that, then it doesn't matter. You can, the Arab Spring was what? Many elections and they elected autocrats.
Yeah. One election, one time. So, yeah. No, thanks, Richard. I appreciate that. And we'll continue tomorrow.
Thank you, David.
Great. Yeah, I just want to take one quick bite at this. What about, for example, Ukraine's, agreement to give up their nukes 30 years ago when they became independent in exchange for help if, you know, they were attacked?
Yeah, so that was a perfect example. That was U.S., Britain, Russia, and Ukraine. And that was a good example of my point about if you're a true grown-up, or in that case, they were learning to become a grown-up. They'd become independent of the Soviet Union. But all the satellites that became independent of the Soviet Union, it was incumbent upon them to put in new institutions, not just military, but courts, independent courts, and even tax systems and things like that. And so for at that stage, for the Ukraine to have given that up is just ludicrous. Now, I don't think they were in a very good negotiating position. They did have the third largest supply, I'm told, of nuclear weapons at the time. And the concern was that rogue officers would make off with these things and destabilize the whole place. But the quid pro quo, when you think about it, was this: get rid of your nukes and we'll promise to protect you from the Soviet Union, Russia. But again, it was an act of the United States and Britain saying, you know, we'll provide your national defense for you. That led Ukraine on a 30-year path of basically being vulnerable. Had instead Ukraine spent 30 years, you know, freeing its economy, diminishing its corruption, building up its military, it would be bigger than the Soviet Union. It would be bigger than Russia today. But it didn't do that. Even today is almost as corrupt as Russia is. And if you look at economic freedom indices, it's no freer than Russia. They're very similar in terms of corruption and economic freedom. Most people don't know that. They think Ukraine is the equivalent of I don't know what, Ireland or something like that, and they just aren't. But now, this doesn't justify them being attacked, but I'm just saying they spent 30 years not really making themselves an independent sovereign country, so they left themselves exposed to Russia, and in the process of all that, kept saying we want to be part of NATO. And to Russia, you just have to understand Russia's interest. Russia has no interest, since the Cold War is over, to have this NATO pressing ever eastward, and then having the last two, Georgia and Ukraine, right up against its border. That's really, to me, the nature of the more recent the conflict since 2014. And I would put NATO as, even though I'm opposed to NATO even when it was formed, the best light I could put on NATO would be it was a defensive alliance until the Cold War ended. And then afterwards, because it didn't disband, even though the Warsaw Pact did, it's an offense. It's a defense and offensive alliance. It was no longer purely a defensive alliance after 1991. And certainly by adding to its members and moving eastward, it was more literally offensive. That's a controversial take, I know, but that's my view.
Well, I'm really looking forward to hearing more about this tomorrow. Quickly, any kind of preview for what we can expect tomorrow? You two are just going at it. No pre.
Well, I would say not to plot spoilers. Rob and I differ on some of these points, but what I think will be interesting about it, and so wonderful that David Kelly will be moderating and hopefully contributing as well, is we both agree with the premise that U.S. foreign policy should be driven by America's rational self-interest. So it would be a very different debate if it was an altruist versus an egoist perspective. So at the Atlas Society, we're pro-American and we're pro-constitutionalism and we're pro-liberty and we want the right foreign policy. So then to differ on applications and to differ in a gentlemanly way, I think will be nice, but we definitely differ.
Good. It's part of the open approach that can happen. Yeah. I plan to, have some breakfast with a good objectivist discussion.
Good.
That's going to be tomorrow at 9:30 Eastern and 9:30 a.m. Eastern. It's going to be Richard Salzman along with Rob Trzynski, both take it with their different takes on Ukraine with TAS founder David Kelly moderating. So you'll want to tune into that. There are links at atlassociety.org. So thank you, everyone, for joining us. And we hope to see you next time. Take care.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.